Okay. Welcome to MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex, and with me is James. Check out our website, MacGuffinMen.com. We most recently talked about Mission Impossible Rogue Nation and Going Clear, Scientology and the Prison of Belief. So yeah, check that out, MacGuffinMen.com. Follow us on Twitter at TheMacGuffinMen. We also recently talked about the Man with No Name trilogy, so you can check that out if you prefer movies with way fewer words. But we'll get to the theme song now.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yeah.
What are we talking about?
Talking about True Detective Season 2.
Yeah, it's pronounced Two Detective, as you've told me so many times. Zoolander. Sorry?
Zoolander, I believe. Yeah, at long last, you know.
a podcast 8 weeks in the making.
Are you nervous to follow up our first True Detective podcast?
Yeah, really. I mean, it was a cultural sensation, so it's always hard to follow up such a cultural sensation as our podcast about the cultural sensation that is True Detective.
We'll try our best, everyone.
Yeah, it had our highest listenership ever. I think it got to about 8. so it was pretty great.
No, but that hilarious joke of mine does touch on one of the facts that I know is going to come up. So let's just get it out of the way. Is the very big shadow cast by season one for season two?
Yes.
And you and I tend to limit our discussions of these the shows that we podcast about or movies you podcast about until we get to podcast about them. But I do get the indication that you feel that the generally negative, we'll put it delicately as,
oh, yeah.
Reception of season two just has a lot to do with the kind of runaway success of season one.
Absolutely correct.
what specifically makes you say that, or is that just something you saw coming and kind of everything's fitting into place, or what?
I was talking to our friend Lee very briefly last night because I wanted to know his opinions about season two, which he hasn't watched, but I didn't know that at the time. I assumed he had. Anyway, and he sort of said, even without having watched it, and we had talked about season one a lot previously, he's like, people seemed kind of primed to hate season two. And like, I agree with him, and I don't know why. I don't know why that is. And I'm really interested to see how this podcast goes, because I don't know how to really talk about something like this, because it's so odd. Because I thought season two was very good. Not like... certainly not without its problems, certainly not without its glaring problems, but I really enjoyed every episode, and like, my level of interest didn't really wane from episode one to episode eight, and there's plenty of dumb shit, but I still found, like, every Monday morning when I'm watching them, I still turned my phone off and just sort of wanted to just experience True Detective. And and I am kind of confused why people have felt so negatively towards it, and it has to be the shadow cast by Rust, specifically Rust, you know, not that Marty had nothing to do with it, but Rust is clearly the superstar of season one. Yeah,
no doubt. Do you have a leading theory on why people wouldn't want to watch a follow-up to something that they were very proud to like?
Because people are dumb. I don't know. I think that's my answer to everything. But no, I think part of the big thing that, and I will say, like, it's so bizarre because people were very excited about the first episode. Before it aired, I referred to the first episode as my most anticipated movie of the year. You know, like, and it was really interesting. And there's this it's the New York Magazine's blog, Vulture, and I read it from time to time. They've got a couple good critics working there. There's plenty of dumb shit on there too, but you know, there's some shining moments as well. It's very True Detective season two. But their editorial ideas at the beginning of the season seem to be, we're just going to talk about True Detective constantly. And there are like 8 different articles about the first episode of True Detective, most of them positive, shading a bit to like, uh-oh, what's happening? But then by episode three, it was all like, we're in every headline, we can't stop talking about why True Detective is terrible. You know, like there was an article.
Yeah.
Like maybe season one of their episode recaps was called like maybe season three of True Detective won't be terrible, you know, and that's like episode four, like you're halfway through, you know, and that's something that I felt like was pervasive in the coverage of, I know I'm singling out one specific media outlet, but I feel like that was pervasive in the coverage of the show. And I think a big part of people's reaction to True Detective Season 1, True Detective Season 2, and I'm saying this, no, like, clearly Season 1 is better than Season 2. It's not a question.
Yeah.
But I think there are some certain things that really sort of didn't help Season 2. Number one, most people didn't watch Season 1, the whole show, week to week, right? Like, even you didn't, you know? And
you!
No,
I'm the True Detective fan number one.
No, I'm just...
No, I know what you mean. No, and your point is absolutely true. Like, I think a lot of people had my experience with it, where they heard about it for four episodes and then kind of got convinced enough to really blitz the last four. And then, you know, and maybe it wasn't exactly four or five where I was, but...
Yeah.
You know, blitz the first few and then, you know, be waiting on pins and needles for the next installment.
Exactly. And like, I know when I told, because I started watching like from day one, just because it seemed like it had the potential to be interesting, and or at least a television rarity. And
you were wrong.
And I remember telling you about, after episode three, I was like, okay, I'm confident this isn't a waste of James's time now, you know, like,
yeah.
And that was leading into the Super Bowl break anyway, so it had a good chance for you to catch up. But and I think that really hurt season two, because people were now watching week to week, so they couldn't just blaze through the first few episodes and get all of the details they needed to get. And I think that hindered the show. I think also the location that the show is set in really didn't help season two, because I like stuff that takes place in LA, big Michael Mann fan, Chinatown's my shit, you know, all this stuff. But I think one of the big reasons that season one was able to exist with this, or succeed with this sort of writing style or dialogue writing style that existed in season one, was that it existed in rural Louisiana. You know, it wasn't this context where LA, like, we know what our perception of LA is. We've seen it on TV so many times, and we know that people talk like, you know, we do in LA, and most HBO viewers have this sort of view of LA, that it is a big city where people like us exist, you know? And that understanding of this place kind of creates a dissonance, because we know that's not how people talk, and for some reason that matters to people, despite the fact that, you know, it's fiction and shouldn't matter that much. But I do think that had a huge impact on the way people treated the show. It's that it now existed in a world they at least kind of recognize. It's not that different from the world that I live in. You know, I live in Toronto, and it's just a big city. And most HBO viewers tend to live in big cities, and they kind of have these ideas of how people exist in big cities, and it's not the way that people in True Detective talk, you know?
Yeah, and I don't know if it's so much as the incongruity of people speaking a certain way in Los Angeles, as it is just having seen Los Angeles so many times before. Don't you think that contributes into it?
Yeah, I would agree. Yes, that definitely does.
Yeah, and I think that part of people talking about season one and how it's atmospheric and ethereal and kind of otherworldly.
Would you say it's dark and gritty?
No, I'm definitely not going to say that. Yeah. It's light and smooth.
Yeah, exactly.
Whatever the opposite.
It's smooth like a Lone Star beer.
Yeah. I think just there's not a ton of stuff set in New Orleans, or, you know, Louisiana, the areas outside of New Orleans that we explore throughout season one of True Detective. I understand that they tried to do more things outside of Los Angeles and use other parts of California as much as possible. Do you think there just wasn't enough of that, or?
Well, it also, I mean, it still looks pretty much like a city, you know, for the most part. You know, there's not a lot of like, we're in the country now, or, you know, the parts where they are actually in the country, like when they find that shed in the woods, Rachel McAdams and Taylor Kitsch's characters, you know, they're out in the woods for not too long. And it's still coastal California is something that we have seen a lot of in movies, you know? Even though it's not LA proper, we've still seen a lot of it.
Yeah, no, definitely. You touched on binge watching and people, the difference between watching it in season one and season two. You said people enjoy it a lot more and they're able to binge watch it. And you mentioned that it's kind of just keeping the details in order. Do you think that's the main factor for people enjoying it binge watching versus week to week?
I think that's something that people would talk about. You know, the reason why shows that I really like, I don't binge watch them unless, you know, it's something like House of Cards and they're just all there. What else am I going to do? I'm not going to like, okay, Friday at 8 p.m. I'm going to watch a new House of Cards, you know?
It's my cheat day.
What people actually get out of something from binge watching, and what I think really heightens the viewing experience to most people watching a show, is that they're able to move on very quickly from plot points that are terrible. I think, or like, you know, moments in the show that they don't like, or anything that they think is stupid, at least they can just keep this sort of propulsive train in motion. Something that I always point to is that I binge watched Friday Night Lights when I watched it 5 years ago. If I was watching that show week to week, I would not have liked that show. Like, I would have stopped watching the second season because the second season had a bunch of terrible things. I think the reason that I got through that season was because I, you know, you could see the finish line. It's like, oh, if there's only 14 episodes in this one, thanks, writer's strike. You know, like, they'll ditch Santiago then. I think that was a big part of my enjoyment of that show, because it was a show with a lot of things that I wasn't crazy about, but since I was able to move through it so quickly, I didn't have to focus on the things I wasn't crazy about, you know? And I think that's something that exists in binge watching for most things, whereas something like Breaking Bad, which you got me onto, you know, watching it, binge watching it didn't really make me like it more. I actually started to like it more when I caught up and was watching week to week, because that's a show that plays with what you know and what you don't know. And that's something that I like about True Detective as well. But it also, you know, let's say for the sake of argument, the last couple seasons of Breaking Bad weren't great. Binge watching would have helped them. You know?
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah. When you just said it's a show about kind of what you know, it's something you like about True Detective. That brings up something I want to ask you that I really haven't heard talked about a lot, and that's the very linear timeline that is the second season.
Yeah.
The first season kind of had three main timelines that were jumped back and forth between constantly. Mm-hmm. Do you think the disappearance of that narrative technique has affected people, made them like it a bit less, and maybe taken away from what made True Detective unique? Because I think a lot of people, for the most part, the nicest thing they'll say about season two is that it's just another solid police drama. Mm-hmm. You know, if we look at it outside the context of as a follow up to, you know, this breakout hit that, you know, people really liked on a lot of different levels, season two is just a pretty, you know, decently put together genre series if you like, you know, cop dramas. Mm-hmm. Do you think that is a big factor in making it not seem so special or unique anymore? The fact that it's told, you know, pretty straightforward?
Partially, because that's actually something that I thought about at the end of episode two, which is when Ray, Colin Farrell's character, gets shot. And the episode ends with him seeming dead, you know, like,
yes. That was a move I did not approve of at all.
Okay, fair enough. And so I assumed he was dead, and I was like, oh, this is interesting. And so I'm spending a bunch of time thinking about it, and it kind of seemed like, and we had seen that one flashback in the first episode with Ray and Frank, Vince Vaughn's character, And I thought maybe we were going to get a lot of how Ray got to this. You know, like we were going to exist in the you know, present with our three other characters for the most part, and we'd have cameos from Vince Vaughn in the flashbacks. But and then I thought Ray's story was going to be told mostly through flashbacks. And I thought that was really interesting and like had the potential to be really interesting. And then I remembered Nick Pizzolatto before the season started saying that he did away with flashbacks or, you know, time shifting. And I was like, well, I guess that idea is not going to happen, you know? And
yeah,
and like, and then Ray's probably alive. Yeah. And I thought that could have been a really interesting turn. But because I think a lot of the show this season was about how did we get to this, and I think it would have been really interesting to show how a character got to this, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I didn't like that kind of red herring of his death, I guess, if you want to call it that, just because I, as I've said on this podcast many times, I really like killing off a main character, killing off a big star early, and I thought that would have been an interesting thing to for them to do so early on.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's something that... you know, shows like the Wire, some very successful shows that I thought this season would try to emulate a bit more, and I think they kind of do to a certain degree. This was definitely not an attempt to just make a Wire wannabe. I understand that, but to take successful elements from other shows, I thought there was going to be more of that. But I mean, about the shifting timeline and telling this more in a linear fashion, that is such a hallmark of the detective story that I kind of didn't, that I didn't really appreciate that was so different in the first season. The idea of moving in this linear fashion, that there is this, you know, mystery, this crime to be solved, something to get to the bottom of, and this just does that in a more straightforward fashion than the first season did.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so speaking of shifting timelines, what, a little hypothetical for you.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, what's the reception of this season if season two was the first season, if we just kind of swapped out the actual content of the seasons?
That's interesting. I have a similar version of the same hypothetical for you. a slightly different version. That's an interesting question. I don't know. I think... I think it's still much less popular than the first season, because I think like we can't something that can't be emphasized enough is how important the Matthew McConaughey renaissance was to season one's success. Like that came
the McConaissance?
Yeah, exactly. I was trying to avoid it, but like the weird shifting in culture on the perception of Matthew McConaughey and the way it turned in the 8 months leading up to True Detective. Like we've got Killer Joe is, I think, where the beginning of that starts. It's the William Friedkin movie that he was in, and people start like it's him in this dark role, and people are like, "Ooh, this is maybe the Matthew McConaughey we've always wanted, but didn't know it." And then Dallas Buyers Club, which he's fine in, and then True Detective. These all come out about an 8 month span. And, we know by the time True Detective comes out, we know that Matthew McConaughey is going to be the lead in the next Christopher Nolan movie. You know, it's like all of these things coming together very quickly and culture sort of realizing, yeah, I can get on board with this. And then he's so good as Rust Cole. Like he's so good in that role. And I think it was just all of these things lining up perfectly. And he's so good in such a unique McConaughey sort of way that it really helps people not only satisfy their newfound need for McConaughey, but also, you know, something that's kind of weird, but also not too weird that the masses can't get down with, you know? So I think that's really important. And I don't think anything like that exists in season two. I think that element of interest would be removed. I think season two of True Detective is certainly more or better received if it's season one, but I don't think it's, you know, the critical smash that season one was, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's not. Like, at the core of it, it's not that.
No, it's just the material is just not there.
Yeah,
no
matter exactly.
The context it's being released in. Yeah, and I just think that a lot of the criticisms I've heard for season two, you could apply to season one if they had been released in reverse order. Mm-hmm. You know, like, just saying, oh, they're putting more characters in now, just, you know, now that it's a hit and try to get more people get in on it. But I feel like if they did it the other way, people would be saying, oh, they're just reducing the characters because now that these people know it's going to go somewhere, they want a huge part of it. Like, it's just, it's so, like, so many of the criticisms I hear, it's, they're pretty vacant. And if you run the kind of mind experiment that, of the reversing the orders of them, you see how much of it is simply context. Mm-hmm. But I will also say that, yes, number one is clearly just the better material, and that, you know, there's no accounting for that.
Yeah, for sure. And one thing that I think, I'll just ask you my hypothetical. So season one, True Detective airs as we've seen it, and we all loved it as we did. And what comes out now is not called True Detective. It's just from the writer of True Detective, and it's his next HBO follow-up. How does the reception change?
I don't think a ton. I really don't think it changes that much. I think it gets, I guess, a bit better reviews because the name just makes it that much more the same product to be followed up mm-hmm. with. But as you know, the particular writer of this show is very well respected and is kind of giving, I think will be kind of looked at in the history of this chapter of television as not legitimizing the author, because that's not the right word, but really propping them up quite a bit. And, you know, there's always jokes about how useless and unimportant the writers are when you consider how much they really do put into the project. But, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think people would just look at it as a season two of True Detective anyway and think him not putting his name on it is just some, you know, artistic hang-up he has, but would think of it in very much the same frame.
Yeah, and there are so many similar through lines, like thematically and just the way people talk, that it's more than just, you know, a writer's follow-up to their, you know, it's more than like The Newsroom to The Social Network for Aaron Sorkin, you know, like there's more connecting thread.
Yeah, and because season one was always planned on just being kind of a miniseries and having a definite ending, I think everyone would just accept that.
Yeah,
you know, I think everyone would just assume, oh, something in his contract said that they couldn't use that title again, or someone got upset and they can't do it. But this is it for all intents and purposes, right?
Yep, fair enough.
Yeah. Think. Do you want to talk about Nick a little bit?
I don't know. It's weird. He's a tough guy to talk about. The one thing that baffles me about, because I mean, I've read a lot of profiles started to come out. The first extended interview I remember reading with Pizzolatto, I forget who it was even with, but it was before the episode 4 premiered of season 1. And it was this lengthy interview, and he would clearly talked in that Pizzolatto voice already. Like he and that Pizzolatto voice that I'm describing is somebody that is very sure of their decisions. But yeah, and there was a good profile in the Hollywood Reporter about him last summer, in, you know, in the in-between space between seasons. And also Vanity Fair published a talked about profile in the lead up to season 2. And the weird thing about him is that, like, when I watch the shows or the things that he's written, it reads so clearly as a man that hates himself. But the way he actually talks about himself is somebody that so clearly loves himself. And I feel like there's this really weird disconnect there. And it makes it really interesting to read about him, even though, like, I roll my eyes every fourth sentence, you know? But I do think the way that people receive the show has kind of been tied into the fact that the people that write about the show are reading these things that are written about Pizzolatto. Like, you know, I'm reading these profiles. I bet, you know, Matt Zoller Seitz, who's a good critic that has written negatively about this season, he's reading these things, and I feel like they're kind of influencing him in some capacity, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I see what you mean. Well, first, I would say that I think the common diagnosis of people who seem like they hate themselves but give off like they're really full of themselves are hiding something hiding it not so well. I guess it just seems kind of, you think he's being reactionary about what's been said about the first season?
No, I don't think he is at all, because he's like that before you know, he talks about himself and his work the same way midway through the first season, you know, before any sort of backlash starts, as he does now about the second season, probably, you know? And
yeah,
like if he's taking some of that back, and I do think he took, I think season two is built on backlash, you know, I think two of the things that he really took into account are two of the biggest complaints about season one. But I think he cares about it and just keeps it down, you know, and just kind of projects this whole I am Nick Pizzolatto, Hemingway in training, you know.
What were those two biggest things?
Women characters. The two people that make it out of the show are the women, you know. And yeah. And also one of the big complaints about the finale of season one was that not enough loose ends were tied up. And so I actually was talking the person I watched the premiere with, my friend who hated season two, we were talking about it after, and she's like, I don't know, man, I just can't get attached to these characters. And I'm like, that's fine. And then I was just thinking about it, and it seemed like they were setting out a lot of just little tiny things, and I sort of assumed that these would all be tied up because of backlash from the first season where things weren't tied up. And for the most part, I think pretty much every loose end is tied up in some capacity, right? Like, this season does not lack answers.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think, yeah.
And I think that actually hurts it. I think its focus on tying up the loose ends definitely hurts it, which is why it kind of bums me out a little bit that he played into what people wanted a little bit. But, like, you know, when Ray says, we get the world we deserve in the second episode, that kind of, like, led me to think even more that, you know, Pizzolatto's like giving them the show they wanted, and now this is how you react to it, you idiots, you know. So yeah,
okay. Kind of on that same vein, I saw an interesting reading of the orgy scene, the sex party scene, the Fidelio scene, if you will.
Yeah, one of my favorite scenes in the series, or okay, the season. Yeah.
Yeah, what did you like about it?
The music. I thought the usage of music was really interesting, and the fact that it seemed so disconnected and kind of tied into Annie's trip. I thought that was really interesting, and the whole just disorienting vibe of the sequence I thought was really great. And it was also a time when the show really picked a point of focus and really stuck with it for a time. Like, even when...
You mean Annie?
Yeah, exactly. And just that sequence that's happening in this place, and we're not going somewhere else during it. Mm-hmm.
And they had, sorry to interrupt, but more main characters. They just had more plot lines to follow simultaneously.
Exactly.
So,
yeah. And I thought that was really helpful. And, you know, Paul is in a different room in the same house as Annie, and Colin Farrell, Ray is watching them both from outside, all of these things tied together. Whereas, say, when you look at Blake's death in the, I think, second to last episode, as Frank initially assaults Blake, they cut away. Like, when he smashes the glass on his head, they like fade into another scene that was going on and didn't really need to be cut. I think it's when Valcaro finds Davis's dead body. But like it kind of kills the tension when you cut away from this moment with Blake, you know. Yeah. Whereas the Fidelio sequence, as you've put it, does not cut away from those things, and I thought that really helps kind of continue this vibe, you know, and keep you locked in for this scene. And I thought it was a well made scene, and the music I think really heightened it. But you were saying an interesting reading about the sequence.
No, I promise I'll get to that. I have a question for you now, though. Earlier, that a common criticism of the first season was its treatment of women.
Yeah.
And you feel that this was reacted to or handled more proficiently in season two?
I think the reason that the two most notable characters that make it out of the show alive are women. I don't think that Pizzolatto has solved all of his problems with women.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. How do you feel? So do you think that there's some other parts that did not deal with female characters very well?
I don't know. It just, I mean, Annie just feels like a character, like you know, like the closest, the easiest way that Pizzolatto could have written a character for a woman was to have her be just one of the guys type of girl, you know, yeah. And which is kind of what Annie is, you know. She's basically, you know, with a few changes, she could have been a man, you know, like a male cop, and as opposed to the lady cop that she is, and you know, not. I like that part.
Yeah,
that's what calls her a lady cop.
That part was very good.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't think there are too many changes that need to be made for her to be another male character. And with Jordan, the other most prominent female character, pretty much every line that she says is trash. So, like, it's just... and, like, I don't know. I've seen Kelly Riley be good in things, and she's just so bad in the show, and it just... It can't all be her fault, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and so the reading I had mentioned earlier was that way that sequence was shot, the orgy sequence, it did what HBO seems to want its shows to do, which is provide a certain amount of almost exclusively female nudity.
Yes. You heard Andy Samberg talking about that. Did you hear the Grantland podcast he was on?
No,
about why they had a bunch of male nudity in seven Days in Hell?
I feel like I must have read part of that.
It was, it's just that he wanted it to be equal opportunity because he felt like there was so much female nudity on every HBO show and never male nudity. And he's just like, yeah, so we wanted to put as many dicks as possible in it. I thought that was so funny.
Yeah, I did. I must have read that because I definitely remember that.
Yeah.
And that he's a huge Game of Thrones fan, which is, you know, would be one of the shows I'd be talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
That in the first season that they're, you know, obviously, all the sex wasn't put in a negative, in a positive light, to put it very delicately. You know, there was sex crimes and these very kind of lewd, unpleasant scenes and discussions about sex and sexuality. But often when there was nudity, it was supposed to be enjoyed. Mm-hmm. You know, Marty had his mistresses, and the nudity and the sex on screen often was... I think positive is not the right word, but meant to be enjoyed, kind of pleasant in a way. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in this one, I think the most nudity we get is definitely that orgy sequence. And it's, you know, what would be seen as kind of, you know, classically attractive females, you know, showing off a lot of skin. But the way that it was shot, it just wasn't pleasant. You know what I mean? It had a very grotesque, kind of like a judgmental tone to it. You know, the men that are enjoying these are bad men who are wrong to be, you know, abusing women this way and to be enjoying sexuality in this fashion.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. And especially since, you know, the sequence from, or the parts of that sequence that are from inside the orgy, as opposed to what Paul and Ray are doing, are all from Annie's perspective. So that is kind of how she views that party, you know. So we're seeing it that way.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. We're kind of seeing the sexual experiences in the first season, either from one of the people who are too consenting, you know, not being paid or being drugged adults, mm-hmm. which is, you know, the positive way. Whereas this one, yeah, we're watching it through her eyes as she's pretending to be someone else who's allowed to be at these sorts of things. And the interesting reading I saw for that was just kind of a judgment on season one and kind of all HBO shows and their nudity and the way that viewers take all this nudity in. And that's something that's very important to these shows, and that people talk about HBO as this really kind of highfalutin, very classy form of television, you know, that's, you know, it's not even television, it's HBO. It's kind of this high culture step above television, but really it's, you want nudity and violence and sexuality along with it. You know, you want all this lowbrow stuff, even though it's this highbrow stuff that you're really clamoring for. And I thought that was an interesting read on one of the most, it was a very, you know, well put together sequence for the reasons you and I discussed before, but kind of had this little element of commentary, intentional or not, that I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, I would say that's definitely unintentional commentary, but I think it's there, and I think that's a really interesting point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We haven't really talked about Taylor Kitsch, Woodrow, or I like
he pronounces hearing, it Woodrow.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's Velcora. I like hearing say it the most.
Yeah,
he just calls him Wooder, I think.
Well, Velcoro has a real struggle just finishing words, like every single word. He'll be saying a sentence, and he somehow cuts off the tail of every single word he says.
Love him for it.
Yeah. Sorry.
Did you feel that character didn't really click, or how do you feel?
Parts of it definitely, like the stuff with his mom, definitely could have done without, and all that stuff. But I thought that, like, and this is coming from somebody that. Up until now has basically thought that Taylor Kitsch is a terrible actor, despite him being a big part of one of my favorite shows ever. And Friday Night Lights, it was always like when we get to the Riggins scene, it was like, fuck, we got to deal with this again. Except when he's a very talented comedic actor, even on Friday Night Lights. But like here, I thought he kind of fit the tone, because the reason I hated him on Friday Night Lights is because he's so goddamn melodramatic all the time. But so is this show. And yeah. He really fits here. And I thought, you know, there was some writing for his character that was really problematic, but... if not problematic, very old fashioned, the sort of this guy struggling with PTSD and struggling with his sexuality and all of these things that have been done a lot and are very cliched. But I thought he was good, and I found him likable. And I really like the scene where him and Ray are driving around and Paul's incredibly hungover, and he talks about, you know, like he has his whole, he's kind of crying and saying, you do what they want, it doesn't matter. And I think that speech ends with him saying, I don't know how to be out in this world. And I thought that scene was really good. I thought he was really good in it as well. But I just, in general, like, I think he had a really good high point. And I think that covers up a lot of the things I didn't like, you know?
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. What?
No, oh, you've just been so anti-Taylor. I just remember trying to get you out to the Grand Seduction, and you're having none of it. So.
Yeah, well, I really haven't liked the way the second half of Don McKellar's career has gone either, so I would have avoided that movie for a variety of reasons.
Okay.
After last night, it's all been downhill.
Okay, so yeah, we can look at kind of our big four here, I think. Mm-hmm. In one of those profiles you were discussing, Pizzolatto said something about doing for Vince Vaughn what he did for McConaughey.
Yeah.
Success?
Sans. no, man. Vince Vaughn's not good in this at all. Like, I think maybe if Vince Vaughn has, like, some idea behind what he's doing, if he was to explain his choices or, why, in my eyes, he's so bad in the show, is that... he's playing a guy that's out of his depth. So he's playing him to look like he's out of his depth, because that's how Vince Vaughn looks in this show, is a guy that, is trying to be somewhere he doesn't belong, which is what Frank is doing. But, yeah. I don't think that was an intentional choice.
Let's chalk it up to the same, meta commentary as that orgy scene and just move on.
Yeah, exactly. Vince Vaughn is a genius.
Okay. And it's been touched on, but, Colin Farrell?
I liked him, but yeah. It was weird. Like, my opinion on him kind of changed once he lost the mustache. Like, for somehow, like, him removing that mustache after the shootout, it made me like his performance less. I think it's just because, like, he's such a pretty individual that it kind of becomes harder to take that voice and the way that he's playing Velcoro. I think it's just, like, he needed that tiny layer of upper lip artifice, you know, just to make him just ugly enough for me to be able to deal with the ugliness of Velcoro, you know? So does that make sense?
Colin Farrell too pretty, Taylor Kitsch not pretty enough. Got it.
Well, no. Taylor Kitsch is even prettier than Colin Farrell. Like, it's a very gorgeous show.
I know, but, that's what I'm saying. That does make sense to me. He seems to be the one that people have the least problem with, and the one that seems to be the best fit for season one of True Detective.
Yeah. Well, if the show has somebody that Pizzolatto was trying to make into his Rust Cole, it's him.
Oh, with dashes of Annie in there, I'd say.
Yeah, that's fair. But I feel like Annie just seems like the most, I don't know, it's hard to call anybody normal on True Detective, but she kind of seems like the most normal of anybody.
Okay. Yeah. She goes for the soliloquies of Rust Cole pretty frequently, though.
Yeah, maybe she just kind of blends in better. Maybe she just pulls them off better. I don't know.
Do you think she was good?
I don't know. I mean, I have a hard time figuring out if anybody was good on this show. Even the people that I'm pretty confident I liked. Like, I liked Nails. I don't know if he was good. You know, like, it's just so weird. That's what makes this show so difficult to talk about. Like, I know the Mayor of Vinci was amazing. I know that is true. And that is one thing I will refuse to listen to contrary arguments to.
It goes out on the Kraken, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Way to go.
I really hope was it Tony, his kid, yelled out "Release the Kraken" as he forced him to drink rum to kill him. I think Rachel McAdams was good, and this is somebody that has no real take on Rachel McAdams as an actress.
Outside of Mean Girls.
Well, Mean Girls could have been a very successful movie without her. I thought the one thing I really liked about her, I really liked the way she looked at people. And this is like something that was just constant throughout the show. And just the way she looked at people was interesting to me. And I don't know. I feel like there was always something that came across from her performance that showed that there was something happening internally in that character. And I thought that was interesting. And of course, it's hard to describe that as my most in the show is just that she looked at people, you know, like, because everybody looks at people, you know, but there was just something about her that was always kind of guarded but also authoritative, and I that was something that throughout the show I found kind of unique and interesting about her.
I think we're actually so far split on our appreciation of the big four actors in the show.
Really?
So far.
Oh, I'm curious to hear your points then.
Oh, I just liked Vince Vaughn.
And really?
Yeah. Oh, I thought he was good. And I thought Colin Farrell was good. I thought...
I thought Colin Farrell was good. We have...
Right,
we
yeah, that was kind of half and half. I thought Taylor Kitsch I agree that the character... it's not as though that was a perfect character being held down by a bad performance. Mm-hmm. But I didn't think he really took off. And I thought Rachel McAdams looked really unnatural a lot.
Really?
I think she doesn't know how to smoke a cigarette. I'm not someone to really smoke cigarettes, so it's not that it bugs me as like in that sense, but
yeah. It's not like when I watch actor or Edward Norton in American History X playing basketball. It's not that dude.
No, but I know that sounds nitpicky, but I think it was something of like really kind of symptomatic of someone who never really fit in like occupied her character's body the way that I thought she should have. And maybe that's something that we're like, it's the same thing we're looking at and seeing differently. And you're seeing it as someone playing kind of guarded and I'm seeing it as just kind of unnatural in a pejorative sense. But I see what you're saying, and that thing about her looking at people, I think is true. And I think some of the better reviews that I've read about this show since finishing it, admit that, you know, some of the flaws that we've both kind of agreed on exist and are problematic. But from time to time, it still has that atmosphere that's really palpable.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, not to the degree that season one had it, you know, when it was doing it its best and when it was firing on all cylinders. Mm-hmm. And there's problems in season one in True Detective.
Oh yeah, of course. And I think we talked about that on our podcast about it.
Yeah, I just don't think we've said anything negative about it yet. So I do want to put it out there that I know that season one wasn't perfect and this is just less than that. Mm-hmm. But I do think it did have that atmosphere at times. I think it was achieved less frequently and less successfully, but I think it was definitely there. And when people say, oh, it's just another crime drama, you know, it's just a 7.5 police show.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that doesn't capture it well, and I think it doesn't capture what it has carried over successfully from season one.
Mm-hmm.
because there are times when that definitely works. And there are just lingering shots that you don't see in a lot of cop dramas that work well in this show, which I still don't think is the best season of this show by a long shot. Mm-hmm. I think it achieves it sometimes. And, you know, even some of those establishing interstitial shots, I'm not sure what's proper.
Yeah, the overhead shots.
Yeah, I mean, some of those I thought were really good and kind of added to that atmosphere, and they kind of give it that, you know, not just the ones of going over miles of Los Angeles freeway, because we've seen that a lot.
Yeah, and, yeah.
You know, that doesn't always do everything. Mm-hmm. But kind of some of the bigger, like the really big shots, you know, I imagine the camera very high up in the sky, you know, on a helicopter, not a crane.
Yeah, it's most overhead shots are typically shot at about 500 feet off the ground. And for this season of True Detective, they went to 1,000.
Yeah, that's what I thought, 1,000 feet. And it kind of gives it, you know, that's when you see the big tracts of land. And again, this is a show about land, you know, so much of the story is land development, things like that. Mm-hmm. But it gives it that kind of sprawling humanity as a cancer, which I'm sure Nick Pizzolatto said a billion times in his life.
He's saying it right now into a glass of Johnny Walker Blue.
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, it gives it those shots, which I don't think I have to explain how this lines up thematically with this show at all. Yeah. You know, I thought it did do things like that well. I liked this season definitely less than you did. And I think part of it is that phenomenon we've talked about where if you do really like something, you'll kind of let, you know, some of the mistakes go.
100%, yeah.
You know, I think if something's a 8, you can let 6 dialogue kind of pass at a time. But if you already think the show is, you know, if you already think it's kind of low and it's a few steps lower than that even, it kind of takes you out a lot. I think I'm probably like 1 point lower on my overall appreciation, but then there are so many things. And because this show does swing for the fences, which is something I always am going to love about this show, you know, they'll put a line of dialogue and if you're not on board, it sounds pretty, you know, it's really glaring. And
yeah. Are you sure your heart just doesn't have blue balls, Jim?
it's not even that. I was fine with that one. Okay. But there are just some throughout the show that, you know, if you're not on board, it's so glaring and it's really hard to kind of get back into it. Mm-hmm. And people have talked about the plot of this show being kind of convoluted, and I don't think that's the problem. I think a lot of people, if you kind of pause their favorite show or movie and ask them to explain exactly what the plot is right now and what's really going on and why they're going to collect this hard drive right now, they can't explain it. But but they like the show so much that kind of stuff doesn't stick out to them. Whereas I think I just didn't like it enough, and so when this show is ambitious, which it is often, and fails, it really, really stands out to me. And that's why I really couldn't get this behind the show for the most part in a really meaningful way this time around.
Yep. I think that is a very thoughtful and smart take on why somebody didn't like this season, as opposed to just maybe next season won't be terrible. You know?
Yeah.
People are the worst.
Do you want to talk about next season?
Nah, I feel like that's, I don't have any hot take on what's going to happen or anything. So I feel like I have nothing to add to the conversation that a bunch of idiots aren't already saying, you know.
What about season one of Velcoro Beats Up Children? Got any hot takes on that?
My favorite new HBO show. I feel like we kind of have to talk about a few things like that were, you know, what the show was actually trying to be about, you know, like, because I think it's trying to be about something, right?
I bet Nick Pizzolatto would like to hear you say that.
Well,
so, yeah.
Well, I think like at its core, it's a show. I will say, the fathers and, children thing is overplayed. I'm sure everybody that watched the show can get on board with that. But like I think the show at its core is kind of about finding companionship, and I found that was kind of interesting. And it doesn't really come into play until the first scene of the last episode, when and admittedly Ray and Annie coming together is kind of like, it seems kind of out of nowhere. that also makes sense in this type of world, the world of crime drama, where it's kind of like you're the only two people that you can trust. You know, it kind of makes sense. But anyway, the whole show kind of becomes about finding companionship, and Frank has always had companionship. Paul, denies himself that. And Ray and Annie kind of come together. And what happens is when people leave their companion, the person that they have decided they trust with their darkest secrets, in Frank's case, he leaves Jordan. And in Annie's case, Ray's case, he leaves Annie, and vice versa. Since Annie doesn't leave Ray, she's allowed to survive. But since Ray leaves Annie, he is not. And and I think that's kind of an interesting, really, I don't know, I think it's a really cool idea for her to be in this show, like letting go of this person that you trust to tell about the person you murdered mistakenly. Letting go of that person, if only temporarily, is what leads to your death. You know, like, you, if you find somebody you trust this much, hold on to them and do nothing, nothing outside of holding onto their hand, basically, you know, like, yeah. If you find somebody you can navigate this world with, then, by all means, just stay together. I found that like a really interesting, really human point for True Detective to be making, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I don't think I quite thought of it that way until you articulated it that way, but that kind of does paint how this series ends, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And it kind of ties in with the whole idea of not accepting who you are, which I think runs through the show as well. Like, Ray's always kind of straddling the line between good and bad. Like, I think he figures out that he's good, and so he's kind of apart from this. But you know, Paul can't accept his sexuality, and Frank, all of Frank's problems come from thinking that he's not a gangster. And so Paul and Frank don't make it out. Ray doesn't make it out. But Annie seems to go through the least amount of arc throughout the show, and like, because she kind of just knows who she is and kind of sticks to her guns for the most part.
Yeah.
And so she's the one that makes it out alive. And same with Jordan. Jordan doesn't really waver throughout the show.
Neither
does Nails. Nails is the other person that makes it out.
Yeah, and I think Annie's struggle is just kind of being strong enough to be who she believes she is, not changing into someone, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And and yeah, those are the two things I really enjoyed. I enjoyed the rat and their tunnels sort of thing that was kind of pervasive through the show. Like, all of the shots that we talked about, those overhead shots, it's kind of like the rats are infesting the city and these are their tunnels. You know, they've just tunneled these roads and whatnot. I thought all that stuff was interesting. And I thought that it's really interesting that Annie escapes, you know, via water, you know, which is a mode of transportation we have not seen up until that point in the show, somewhere where the rats couldn't catch her through the water.
Yeah.
You know? I thought that was cool. And so many, I mean, we've talked about a couple of them, but the things that I loved the most about this show were the scenes where it kind of used fewer words and played with just tone and music, specifically like the orgy. I thought the choice of music elevates that so much. My favorite sequence in this season was the closing of about the last 8 to 10 minutes of the first episode, where the bar performer, whoever she was,
Lara Lynn, what up,
yeah, it's just playing a song that she keeps repeating, "This Is My Least Favorite Life." And Ray and Frank are sitting across the table from each other, not saying anything. Ray's just smoking, and they're just looking at each other. And it's just this electric scene where nothing is getting said, but it's so good. And then they have a little conversation, and we cut to Paul on his motorcycle when he eventually turns his light off. And we get Annie in a casino drinking and getting kicked out and giving them giving security the middle finger as she gets thrown out. And all of these characters brought together, none of them really saying anything, other than the Frank and Ray conversation that's pretty brief. But it's just all of these characters coming together and being linked together in this sequence that's just so good, and ends with plot advancement. It ends with Paul finding Casper's body. But it's what leads up to that that's just so good. It's this kind of like this weird off-putting tone that's so bizarre for a cop drama. but it's just so perfectly done, and I think it's great.
Yeah, did you see that comparison between what Ray's dad says to him about his dream and the way Ray actually dies?
No, I love the first scene with Ray's dad.
He's so good.
Well, Fred Ward. Yeah, I mean that one of the big mistakes of True Detective season two is that they wasted Fred Ward on such a small part. Like he has the face that was built for this show. You know?
Oh, 100%.
And same with David Morse. I feel like David Morse was terribly underused as well. And it's such a bummer that they got used in a down season in such small roles because they're both such talented men. Yeah.
Oh, I know. It definitely could be Russ Cole's dad in season one, you know, like it wouldn't be crazy if Fred Ward was cast as that.
Yeah.
Which is saying something about his face.
But I love that sequence. I loved, especially, you know, when that comes at the beginning of season three, you don't know if Ray is dead or not. And at the end of that scene, you still don't know if he's dead or not, you know, until they cut to his body and you see him wake up. And I thought that scene was so good. And one of my favorite scenes in the show as well. And it was kind of like it combined a lot of things I liked about David Lynch with a lot of things I like about Cormac McCarthy. And whereas
two fun names.
Exactly. Whereas Pizzolatto aims for those things a lot, he fails a lot. Whereas this time it really came together. You know, like that was like a Twin Peaks scene meets, you know, a monologue from The Crossing. You know, like it was really, really good. And I think some of the biggest misfires in the show do happen when he tries to be David Lynch too much. But yeah, I thought that scene was great. But you're saying the comparison?
Yeah, you know, his father says, I forget the exact wording, but, you know, I see you in the woods being chased by men. The trees are giants. You're so small. Mm-hmm. You try to shoot them and they cut you to pieces or something like that.
Yeah.
And that was episode three, right?
It's the beginning of three.
Right, when he gives that speech. So there's a side-by-side comparison, I can send it to you, of him, his speech as he's giving it to him in the final shootout mm-hmm. of Falcoro.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you the shot and you'll recognize it, but when he says the trees, they're giants and you're so small, it's that shot of him mm-hmm. looking straight up the trees and they look massive, even though they are very big trees. You know, he's looking straight up the tree, so it's kind of covering the bottom of the frame, and then then we get the reverse shot of it looking down on him and he looks so small at the trunk of this tree.
Yeah.
And it lines up perfectly with his father's description of the dream he has of his death. And I thought that was just a really nice, you know, a big reach back. We'll add to the, you know, rewatchability or the kind of internet Easter egg finding kind of mythos of the show. But yeah. I think it was a really nice way to seal everything. And for a show that I think people, or for a season, I think people kind of called, you know, scattered, I think it shows it as a bit more deliberate and well thought out than people are giving it credit
for. Yeah, exactly. It kind of, like, I think one of the biggest problems with it is that it didn't really pick its moments, you know, like, and also kind of everybody talked like a Nick Pizzolatto character as opposed to just Rust, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that really hurt it, you know, because you kind of need these grounding things. But yeah, I agree. As that death scene was starting, I was like, oh, this is cool. You know, like I like this, you know? Yeah. And I thought it was cool that they did a tie-in. It got a little too end of training day for me when Ray actually dies. And they did that whole thing where they tried to make footage that wasn't shot at a higher frame rate into slow motion, which I hate.
Yeah.
At least the setup for that scene I was a big fan of because of that tie-in that you're talking about. Yeah, Nick Pizzolatto makes mistakes, but not an idiot, you know?
Yeah, I'll get behind that.
So with that glowing review of True Detective Season 2, we might as well sign off. Thank you for listening, and be sure to check back for our next episode.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.